brother John.
Good morning, Jerry. The weather's looking pretty good here. Mid-60s, feeling pretty good. Going to have a nice day. Postcard perfect. Got to get up to 80. A lot of sun. Looking forward to the day. And looking forward to this podcast.
Yes, well, I'm sure you have your T-shirt on. Weather like this,
sure
you need
do.
A good T-shirt.
T-shirt day, every day is a T-shirt day, that's for sure. And when we have our podcast, we make especially sure that we're ready. We're all in uniform and have our T-shirt on.
I am definitely in uniform. And you know, we were talking about this yesterday a little bit. Just for the sake of convenience and that, you know, washing and drying stuff isn't that easy in my little apartment. So I just, this may sound strange, but I just wore my T-shirt into the shower and put a little soap on it, rinsed it off, wrung it out. And, it, you know, the sun here in Texas is so hot. After about 3 hours, it was dry. So I have a hand-washed, sun-dried T-shirt on right now. I guess that's some kind of a hipster thing now, right? Artisanal T-shirt.
Let's just say you've done stranger things, which we don't need to talk about. But I take the more conventional method. But I do respect yours because your probably T-shirt will last longer than mine, and rather than using a washer and a dryer. So
that's right. But that colors on this, the colors on mine have stayed so beautiful. So I'm happy that I'm doing that. And you guys, if you don't have a T-shirt, here's how you get them. You go to shirt.thebro.show. That's it. All right.
That works.
Yeah, it does work. So what do we got on we got a pretty interesting podcast. We worked pretty hard on this week, especially you, John. Jeez.
Well, we felt that with the North Korean missile launching that it kind of led us to thinking in terms of trying to take our three categories, sports, film, and fake news, and talk about them in terms of I wouldn't call it prelude to war, but more like prelude to crisis. So what we've done.
Yeah, we were both flashing on the Cuba Missile Crisis, which we lived through.
Yeah, so that'll be something we will talk a little bit about. But this, so what we're going to do is we're going to start by talking about a World War II and how baseball prepared and how they interacted with the war in terms of before the war, during the war, and how it changed dramatically some of the things that came out of the war. Second, we're going to take a look then at a movie that is based upon called From Here to Eternity, considered one of the, I would say, a top 50 movie overall by AFL, American Film Institute. It's and what we'll do, what's good about this one is it's a two-hour movie of which 15 minutes is the war. And the rest of it has to do with the preparation and how they were reacting before the war. So we're going to go into that a little bit, and then we'll start. We'll finish up by taking a look at the what's happening now in terms of Korea and our read on it, and how it looks compared to some of the other things, such as the Cuban Missile Crisis, etc. So we got a full plate, no doubt.
Yeah, let's do that baseball.
So we're going to take a look at baseball, and the fact is that, of course, the critical day that we'll be centering on for both segments 1 and 2 is going to be December 7th, 1941. Pearl Harbor Day. But when it comes to baseball...
Also the birthday of my grandson, Ian.
Ooh, very good.
Not the year, but the day.
Yes. So the draft, actually, the baseball, you know, the U.S. just didn't, you know, all of a sudden jump into the war without being prepared. The war had been going on in Europe with Germany invading Poland. So as a result, we had already started in terms of, you know, machinery, getting things ready, prepping, and actually had our draft in 1940. That's when it started. And a couple of the baseball players actually got drafted. So it isn't like it all of a sudden rushed in, but obviously December 7th was a very, you know, sudden surprise day.
Yes.
So what happens? We've got December 7th. It's on a Sunday. And sure enough, the next day, guess who's scheduled to meet? All the owners of Major League Baseball are going to meet. Now, part of the background we need here is we need to understand that baseball at this point is being run under the iron hand of Commissioner Kenesaw Mountain Landis, and his reign as the commissioner started back in 1920 in reaction to the 1919 Black Sox scandal. Baseball felt they needed a real shot in the arm and have somebody who would come in that's got a very squeaky clean reputation, and of course the judge did, and and also have an iron fist. And he met both of those criteria and had been, you know, ruling the roost, you know, since 1920. So here we come 1941. And he's really confronted with a problem because, you see, Landis didn't get along at all with President Roosevelt. And so there was a little bit of tension as he wanted to address the issue of, well, does the government, the federal government, want us to play baseball? Are we going to be given a platform upon which we can play baseball? These were questions that were pondered.
Right.
What's kind of interesting is you take a look at that December 8th owners meeting, which is being conducted by Commissioner Landis, is two things were talked about in that movie, in that meeting, which would never happen. One was the idea that the St. Louis Browns, doormat of the American League, were interested in moving to Los Angeles.
Right.
Well, what happens is everybody kind of laughs and says, yeah, you know, sure, we're going to be able to travel to L.A. during the war. And number two, we're right on the Pacific coast. We're closer to Japan. That didn't fly. But the more interesting thing was that William Wrigley proposed to put lights on Wrigley Field. And they kiboshed that one because they said, we need to have the materials that you need for that will probably be greater used in the war effort. So they canceled that. But it's amazing how a couple of things could have dramatically changed baseball if we wouldn't have had, the war. So as we move on, Landis is confronted with the need to address this issue with Roosevelt. What he does is he sends a letter to Roosevelt, and Roosevelt responds. And between the time that Roosevelt responded to the letter and sent out his what's called historically the green light letter, which says baseball can continue, there was about 6 weeks and a lot of tension. So Clark Griffith, the president of the Washington Senators, he was really tight with the president. And the reason he's tight is because every year he would go and invite the president to throw out the first pitch and give him an American League season pass. So it was just the natural thing for him to do was to make an appointment, go and visit with the president before the season started. That meeting, basically, plus Landis's letter together, is what brought forth what's called the green light letter, in which what the president says is that we do need to continue baseball as much as we can. We are not going. We are going to make players subject to the draft. However, what we will do is we will do whatever we can do to accommodate the travel needs of the baseball clubs. And in addition to the facts, on the other side of it, we expect the baseball clubs to over the edge support the war. And what they did examples of that were they have doubleheaders. So the idea of continuing the war was to meet and improve morale on actually three different fronts. One was basically the fans, the ability to take the fans that are located in the states, have them be able to have a pastime, a recreational event that they can go to take their minds off of it. Number two were the soldiers, the ones who were overseas, who could get information about baseball. Baseball was the number one spectator sport of the day, you know, not to be confused with now, which we have, you know, basketball and football are up there too.
Yeah. So I have a question for you though, John. Is there a method of them hearing a broadcast like Radio Free Europe or anything like that?
There was a way that they could hear it, and they used it to do the World Series. The World Series was probably the only thing. I can tell you, by the time I got to Vietnam, we were getting a game of the week. So I think I'd be able to listen to one game. Back then, they were basically doing the World Series, and that was about it. But it was
live?
A big deal.
Live?
Yeah, live. It was being done live.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. The other thing is that what we have is we've got, you know, in addition to we've got the fans, and we've also got the players that are interested in it. And those were probably the two most important parts that we have to look at. So there was a lot of going back and forth, but we're able to continue baseball. Now, 1942 here was really not that affected because the draft was still in its infancy. So there weren't a lot of players drafted. So 42 went as usual. It isn't until we get to 43 and 44 that we end up having the need to, a lot of players are drafted, the Joe DiMaggio's, the Ted Williams, the Hank Greenbergs, the Bob Feathers. All the stars are in uniform. Now, the fact is the roles that these stars played in the war varied, and it varied not only based on the individual, but based upon what time of the, in the war. Later in the war, more guys were getting involved in combat. But at the beginning, we did have some of the players, such as Joe DiMaggio, that were leading calisthenics and playing a lot of baseball. You know, every the Navy was interested in having their baseball team, the Army, et cetera, based upon having all these stars there. So the temptation was very great.
Sure.
They didn't have to actually do another green letter every year. In fact, Clark Griffith was not able to even get his meeting scheduled after the one in 1942. Oh. In 43 and 44, he was rebuffed and was never able to get the president to throw out the first pitch or else give him his American League season pass. Now that's, you know, I'm sure that the president had bigger things on his plate than dealing with Clark, who was a very, very political type guy and kind of a BSer. So, you know, he had more important things to do. In addition to the fact, we know that the president's health wasn't exactly going on the upswing at that point. It was, it was on the downside. Even in those years. So we had a diluted form of baseball, but the fans seemed to appreciate it. And it resulted in players in the teams getting a little bit more ingenuity in terms of their approach to procuring players. We found a lot of guys were coming that were, you know, the draft age at the time started out to be 30. Got to creep up to probably about 34, 35 by the end of the war in terms of the age limit. But so as a result, we had a lot of guys come back who maybe hadn't played for 3 or 4 years or who were sitting in the minors. And by the way, the minor leagues are is decimated to the point that they actually go from about 40 teams to start the war to 12 teams, 12 leagues, excuse me, not teams, 40 leagues versus 12 leagues by the end of the war. So the resources that the major league had to the normal area they would look to get to get new players would be that. So they were the youngest player that ever played in the majors. When does he play? In World War II. At the age
How
of
old
15
was
and 11, 11 15
Whoa.
Years and like 11
Whoa.
Months. An overgrown kid that named Joe Nuxhall, who got rocked in his only in his only appearance against the St. Louis Cardinals. But
about four or five years later, did come back. What does rocked mean? What does rocked mean?
Means he got lit up.
Was
means he got touched. Means he got basically gave up a lot of hits.
Oh,
he got lit up.
Okay.
It would be a better word.
Okay, I got you. I got you. Okay.
So he's an example of you know, some of the ways it actually changed the scouting a little bit, because up to that point, scouts would go just to the minors to look for players, but now they had to stretch out and kind of. So it changed that a little bit. So we approach the 1945 season. 45, things are getting really grim in a variety of ways. Number one, we've got fewer and fewer players that are going to be available. So there was just a lot of question about do we cancel or not. The two other events take place. Number one is Kennesaw Mountain Landis dies in November 1944. So here we are. We're just, you know, within 3 or 4 months of a new season in 1945, and we don't have a commissioner. The second thing is that so there's a lot of jockeying back and forth about who should be commissioner. So they're dealing with that.
Right.
And then we've got the fact that in April of 1945, FDR passes away. So in that period of time, we have the National League president, Ford Frick, was extremely political. And what he did is he was very tight with a Kentucky congressman slash governor, Happy Chandler. Happy Chandler was a very social guy who, you know, as far as he's concerned, he didn't find a person who didn't like him. He always was able to kind of win people over with just his overall social ability. So he was ahead of the Armed Forces Committee in the Congress. So what he did is Fort Frick and him kind of got together and were able to make it so that baseball could continue, even without a green light. Probably, and this is amazing, FDR dies in April. 3 or 4 weeks before that, he basically sends out a communique to say baseball should continue. In addition to that, okay, what was interesting was that he realized that he was dying and that he wasn't going to last through the baseball season, even maybe make it to the baseball season. He called in Clark Griffith to basically have his final little talk with him, just out of, you know, just being a good guy and realizing that he hadn't seen Clark in a while. So I thought that was kind of nice.
Yeah, yeah. Now, that's nice.
But the road for the baseball, ML Major League Baseball in 1945 was not necessarily as smooth as Ford Frick and Happy Chandler would have liked. There was another element, another committee called the Army Mobilization Committee that was run by another congressman named Burns. I don't know much about his background, but he was not what you call pro baseball. In addition to the fact that we find that the fans are getting a little bit hardened, you know, as the war, you know, there's a little euphoria at the beginning, and everybody wants to be part of it. But when you get into the third, fourth year of the war, it kind of drains you.
Yeah, now you're in the shit.
All of a sudden, those guys, those 4F guys that are out there having the ability to play, don't look quite as good.
Yep.
And they're saying, why are those guys out there playing? They should be having a uniform on. So there was a realignment as to how they approached it in a couple of ways. Number one, what they did is they took a look at what the players were doing that were already drafted. And the players that were getting the cush jobs were being reassigned onto the combat field. They also took a look and reevaluated all the 4Fs. And a lot of those 4Fs then, they ended up... So there was this approach.
They got reclassified, I assume.
They got reclassified. Many of them got reclassified. Some of them didn't.
Okay.
And we know that, you know, all this is based upon getting in and, you know, being drafted. It's all based upon your local draft board.
Yep.
And I was just astounded that Stan Musial played, you know, didn't get into war until 1945.
Right.
And it is just, as much as I've tried to research it, I'm just, I've had to conclude that his local draft board was somewhat lenient to an extent before Musial ended up going into the Navy for the 45 season. So that kind of goes in terms of the you know what happened with respect to the war. Now one of the there's a lot of outcomes we could talk about. I would just briefly say that just because a lot of the players had cush jobs in there doesn't mean we don't have some war heroes that were baseball players. If we take a look at it, we find we had two professional players get Medal of Honor. Both of them passed away. Incredible stories. I'm just finishing a book called, and it's Francisco Nzema, called The Game Must Go On, the history of the, you know, of what happened between baseball and World War II, the interaction. And this book is just filled with some amazing stories. We also had another thing where the players, the handicapped players, such as players with one, we had a player with one arm called Pete Gray.
Yeah, that's the picture. That's the picture you have.
And what happened is we have a player here who did very well in the minors. He worked his way up and was able to play. And the St. Louis Browns looked upon him in 1945, and they were even though they won the pennant in 44, they didn't draw very well. They looked at him as a means by which to improve their club a little bit, but more important, maybe be a draw because of having the promotional aspects of having a one-arm player. The sad news is Pete Gray was never accepted by the players. The Browns had just won the pennant, and they felt that having Pete Gray play diminished their chances of winning another one. Because Pete Gray, to be perfectly honest with you, you know, it's sort of like if you lack a certain skill, such as if you're blind, you can hear better, or this or that. Pete's able to become, he's very fast. He's an incredible fielder with one arm.
Wow.
But there's one thing he just cannot overcome, and that's the fact he was just not going to be able to bat that well. And Pete could get around on a fastball with the best of them, but the problem is that he couldn't adjust his swing for slower pitches such as curves. So he ended up with a batting average that hovered around 200 the whole year. And they're
kind of remarkable, though.
Oh, it is.
200.
It is. I mean,
200 is.
Well, he didn't ever hit all his goal was to try to hit a home run in the majors. He never was able to do that, but he was able to, even just getting to putting the ball on the ground, he's left-handed. So all he had to do is get that ball on the ground and hit it soft, and he could run like hell to first base and get a single and steal bases.
Wow.
But the tension lies in the fact that when he would be playing, players would be upset because they thought that he cost them games because he maybe wasn't hitting clutch. And when he wasn't, when he wasn't playing, he was getting, you know, just sitting on the bench and kind of moping around. He was a kind of a dark guy.
He had a chip on his shoulder, probably.
Yes, he was a chip on your shoulder guy all the way. You hit it right on the head. We had one other player who's just the opposite. His name is Bert Shepherd, who had one leg. He was a guy who had flown some combat, and so and it was amazing because he flew. His plane went down. He became a prisoner of the Germans, and he was a prisoner that was treated relatively well because he ended up being close to a prison that would take care of him and take care of his medical needs because his leg basically was blown off during his crash. And after they got done with that, they were amazed at his ability to come back and be able to do normal things. So he was considered kind of a freak, and as a freak, he was treated a lot nicer than the normal prisoner was. So he always had a really good attitude. And when he got out, I don't know how he was able to get out before the war was over, but he, in 1945, and he had been pitching prior to this, he was a pitcher. He came back, and of course, Clark Griffith, being the kind of guy, being a kind of a political, promotional guy, he saw this guy who played for the Senators and said, well, let's see if he can't be our batting practice pitcher. And before you know it, in some, you know, crazy game where the Senators were losing 20-2 or something like that, they let him pitch a couple of innings, and he did well. So he had a great attitude. And Pete Gray actually did too, when it come to interacting with other people with handicaps.
Yeah.
He would encourage them, and both of these guys would do it. Pete was, like I said, just like you said, chip on your shoulder, you know, determined, hardcore, always kind of little anger to him, kept him going, while Bert was a more easygoing guy. The other thing I'd like to point out is no matter how much you might prepare for something in terms of a conflict like this, there's always going to be some hiccups, and baseball was able to play a great role in this. I would like to only conclude by talking about the fact that baseball, and I think just the war in general, it accelerated the integration because during the war, blacks were still segregated. They had their own forces. Now that doesn't mean in combat that things didn't kind of, you know, get mixed up and they were with each other, but we find that even though we had the blacks recruited and enlisted, etc., they were quite often given separate combat units, and in even worse than that, quite often given very perfunctory
diminished roles,
very low life support roles. I read part of what I was able to read about that I didn't know much about was this China, Burma, Indochina front, which you don't hear much about.
Yeah. No, you
in
don't.
In which case, of course, when they were trying to build roads, that was a logical place to have the blacks, units go. What happened was what brings us together here is that at the end of the war, there is a GI World Series in the European theater, where they were going to have the best teams play against each other. And it all boiled down to two teams, one that was primarily – that had black players that played against General Patton's team that was loaded with white stars.
Right.
So it was a five-game series of which the blacks won. the ones who they had to buy. And the black players in it, Leon Day and one other guy, I forget his name, who later, Leon Day never played in the majors, but there were a couple, Willard Brown. Willard Brown was on the team and was a star, and he ended up playing in the major leagues for a short period of time. So we have this interaction not only in combat, but we also have this recreational interaction that spurs on. So guess what happens in toward 1947? Two things. Number one, we integrate the armed forces, and two, we integrate baseball, all in the same year.
Wow.
So that kind of concludes my section on the war and baseball in World War II. It just shows you that although you come together, a lot of things can happen. You're not necessarily prepared for it, but the U.S. and baseball, the government, everybody reacted very well. And we had some good things come out the other end back in 45 and 46.
They did a lot of fundraising, too. They sold a lot of bonds.
Yes, I should have pointed that out. FDR was adamant about a couple things. One, he wanted to have baseball accessible to the fans who were working hard in the war plants. And two, he wanted Major League Baseball to support night games and support the bond funds. Gathering scrap material was another big thing. Yep. The other thing they did is that since we did have these teams that were being compiled by the different armed forces, that the major league teams would quite often play against them, and they'd be fundraisers for the war in terms of sale of bonds, et cetera. So you're exactly right. I'm glad you pointed out that baseball did play a major role in supporting the war.
Yeah, super platform to get to people.
Yes,
it did a lot for the morale, I'm sure, of the whole country to not have something constant, something that persevered through all that. And like you say, toward the end of the war, I mean, that's when it always gets tough. But that 45, that must have been hard times.
45 was hard. I thought that, this might be a natural reaction, but I thought, well, gee, what happened with the other sports? How about football? In fact, football is being played during Pearl Harbor because it's on a Sunday in December. Wow. What happened is football had the same – they didn't have the formality of getting a green light, but they ended up having to take certain teams and combine them. So my favorite was they combined the St. Louis – the Chicago Cardinals and the Pittsburgh Steelers. And so they ended up being 0-10, and so they were called them the Carpets. This car hits.
They
were thinking more probably in terms of being a doormat and a rug than they were of being two combined cities.
Yeah, yeah.
So, every sport, pro basketball wasn't that formed at that point, but NFL was. And so they had to react to it too, and they did theirs through basically contraction is what they did in that regard. So, very interesting part of our history there, baseball and World War II.
And you and I kind of grew up in the echo of World War II. You were born in 46. I was born in 48. We were the boom babies, all the babies who got – the U.S. went through an incredible period of prosperity following the war. We went through a lot of changes. A lot of women were working in factories. They got sent home. The boys who came back had to get jobs. And it was a very interesting transition. It changed our country, I think, forever. And growing up in the 50s was really a lot of people complained about the 50s, when we were in the 60s, how it was all, bland and whatever. But I have nothing but great memories of the 50s. I loved it. I thought our country was, probably at its best in a lot of ways. And
a lot of people consider it the golden age we've had. There are a lot of things that took place. I would say one thing we didn't even talk about, Jerry, that to give you a good example of how the war influenced us. General Eisenhower, who became our president in the 50s, was very impressed with the road system that they had in Germany.
Yep,
with their expressways.
Yeah,
the Autobahn and all that. So what happened was the beginnings of the interstate system that we kind of take for granted right now, as we go in and out of cities and go bouncing from city to cities, all started based upon Eisenhower's favorable impression of what he saw in Germany during the war, translating into what he then started with the interstate system in the 50s. So that's another good example of an output. And we'd be remiss. The bottom line is we can't cover all the social aspects of what came out of it. You mentioned the women working. Bottom line is the way women approached their lives was dramatically changed and affected by the war. Once they realized that they could be a very, very important part of the workforce, that basically translated into what we have now, where we find a lot of times companies are being run by women. Where does a lot of that starts? And if it isn't starting with the war, it's basically accelerated by the war.
Yes, I think it was. I think it was. I think you're right about that. Yeah,
we can't hit all the social aspects, but I don't want to hit on anybody's bad case by at least mentioning, you know, these a couple of these other things.
Yeah, so, yeah. Given that echo, 10 years after the war ends, we have a great movie made, and you know, I'd never before. John and I were talking last week. Said, "Well, let's have this movie from here to eternity." And you know, I'd never seen the movie. My wife had never seen the movie. We'd seen outtakes from the movie all over the place. We felt like we knew the movie a little bit, but then we actually watched the movie in black and white, like the original, like God intended. And it's weird to watch a movie filmed almost entirely in Hawaii, which is beautiful and colorful, in black and white, but it worked. And it was one incredible movie. The fact that they put this together and got all these people in one movie is kind of a miracle in and of itself. The story itself is not what you would expect. From the name, I guess, you know, you kind of would get that it's not purely about the war. It's about the buildup to the war and the lives, you know, 4, 5, 6 lives of people, very interesting people, who were in Hawaii at the time that Pearl Harbor happened, the bombing. And it is fascinating. It's a 2-hour movie, but I was shocked how quickly that thing went by and how great some of those performances were. And there were a couple people in this movie who really had never had roles like this at all and performed like stars. The one you know of is Frank Sinatra because of The Godfather. Everybody has this thing about, his Godfather got someone threatened in order to get him in the movie. Who knows? I don't know. But the other one is Burt Lancaster, who's in action movies and was a circus performer before he was an actor, who actually got a dramatic role, and he was an incredible dramatic actor, and I was stunned by his performance.
This movie is probably bigger than the story itself because of not only it was a best-selling novel a couple years before, so the build-up to making this movie and the stories behind it are as significant as the movie is itself. And we're talking about a movie here that was nominated for 13 Academy Awards and won 8 of them.
Wow.
Including supporting actor Sinatra and supporting actress Donna Reed. We'll talk a little bit more detail about those two. But part of the reason that they didn't win Best Actor was because both Montgomery Clift and Burt Lancaster were up for the Best Actor. So they were kind of splitting the votes in their regard. And that played a big part in them and not getting that. So yes, Jerry, you've couched this and set it up very well in terms of the fact we've got, even though we have a story here that is at the very beginning of the war. In fact, only about 15 minutes of the movie are during the bombing of Pearl Harbor. The rest of it is a build-up in which we learn about this very interesting cast of characters. Just kind of say a couple things. The book was considered impossible to make into a movie for two reasons. It was too long, and I guess probably they called it From Here to Obscenity in terms of
it was racy.
The censorship that would be needed in order to bring it to the film.
The book itself covered some of these things in great detail. And a kind of unheard of detail, given the times.
What I'm going to do is kind of briefly go through some of the characters.
Okay.
And that way I think we can hit the myths. We can hit
Let's do it.
The relationships, this and that. We start with Burt Lancaster, who, at this point, as you've already mentioned, was primarily known for his action roles, but took this on. And one of the interesting things that happened is that Burt Lancaster has what happens is he is the first sergeant of a company that's run by he runs the company, but the figurehead captain feels that his success route lies in him having this incredibly good boxing team. So Lancaster is first confronted with Montgomery Clift, who has been recruited to box by the captain. And in the inside story is that Burt Lancaster was scared to death having to have his first scenes with Montgomery Clift. Montgomery Clift was a very serious, super prepared guy who would always take his roles to the point of actually making sure that he could do what was in that. There were two things that he had to really study hard. One was he was a bugler, and he drove everybody on the set nuts. He was constantly playing his bugle. And even though they used another person, to do the bugling, he would do it so that he would look like he was the guy.
Yes.
The other thing that he wasn't quite as successful at accomplishing was boxing. He never got boxing down, but he tried as hard as he could. And so, if you watch the movie, you can probably, if you're aware of it, see the scenes where we have a stand-in come in and do that. The other thing is we've got the wife of the captain, Deborah Kerr, who has a relationship with the sergeant, Burt Lancaster. Now, there's a couple of interesting things going on here. Number one, we've got the closeness, and obviously we've got the first sergeant Lancaster who is risking his military career by going out on the sly and with an affair with the captain's wife. The captain's wife, Deborah Kerr, plays against type to the hilt. This is a prim, proper British actress who is known more for playing mothers, playing very polite people. In fact, my favorite one is what comes out of here that everybody knows is the swimming scene where they're basically embracing each other as the waves kind of go over them. A lot
legendary.
Of that was done. Yeah, it's legendary. And the fact is that a lot of it was just off the cuff because they originally were going to do that scene standing up. And needless to say, they did it while they were lying on the beach. And the other thing, the inside story is that they did a lot of serious rehearsing, Burt Lancaster and Deborah Kerr on this role. They spent a lot of time off the screen making sure that they had that down.
Well, they had to do their work down, just like Montgomery Cliff, you know.
Yeah, you're right. So the other thing is that Deborah Kerr was my favorite quote is that when she's taking the cheesecake photos with her swimsuit on, she says, "I feel naked without my tiara on." It's one of my favorite lines. To show you, she is basically plays a woman with slightly loose morals, but for a good reason. Her husband and they're not getting along. And the fact is that in the movie, she ends up having to have a hysterectomy because of during childbearing, and she then is not able to have children again. While in the book, guess what she's got? She's got a social disease. She's got gonorrhea that has been given to her by her husband.
Ooh.
So one thing I didn't mention at the beginning is that there were two sets of codes, censorship-wise, that the movie had to go through. It not only had to go through the movie censorship code, but it had to go through the Army because they were using
Schofield.
So that was also important.
The Army base, yeah.
Moving on to Montgomery Cliff and Frank Sinatra. Now, the Frank Sinatra thing, as Jerry mentioned, is all a myth in terms of him getting the role. We've talked about that in another podcast. But what's kind of interesting, Frank Sinatra was up to that point in time, had been primarily a song and dance man playing for MGM. And was at the bottom. Was at the low end of his career. He had just had trouble with respect to his movie contract. He had been let loose by MGM. He wasn't doing well in terms of live performances and attendance. In addition to the fact that the movie studio Columbia had just let him go.
Right.
And he also had a very tempestuous marriage with Ava Gardner. So all these things together, Frank read the book and said, "Maggio." Private Maggio in the book, "I am Maggio, I am the man." And so he pushed very hard to get that role. But his wife, Ava Gardner, probably had the ear of Harry Cohn and also was more instrumental than getting it than anything to do with the mafia. Montgomery Cliff and Frank Sinatra had a very, very good relationship. But the thing, Frank needed Montgomery Cliff in terms of teaching him what to do in a dramatic fashion, since he'd been a song and dance man at the MGM studios. The other thing they had in common is they were big drinkers. And James Jones was also there as an advisor. Those three were like the three musketeers. When they weren't doing the movie, they were out prowling at night and staying up to all hours drinking. And in fact, when they brought everybody over to Hawaii, they had a big drinking bout on the plane, which lasted a long time. And they basically had to be carried off the plane to not drink what did. And in fact, one of the other things that happened during the movie was that Montgomery Clift was supposed to play a drunk, but the problem is he drank too much before was played, and he actually passed out and couldn't play a drunk during the movie a couple places.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was
again. He's just doing prep for his role, though.
Yeah, just a little prep.
That's all.
The fact is, the director, everybody, the performances were incredible in spite of some of the challenges in the urban myths that you have to hear about. The one person we haven't talked about is Donna Reed. Now, you think about Donna Reed, and you think about the Donna Reed Show after the movie and before the movie, It's a Wonderful Life. That's Donna Reed. So again, against type, she plays in the movie. She plays a hostess of a social club where she meets Montgomery Clift. In the book, she plays a prostitute. In either case, she's against type.
Right.
So she has a very important part. It's kind of
interesting. It's a little this hostess thing is a little ambiguous in the movie.
They kind of leave it to the imagination to a bit.
Yes,
so
they do.
Kind of figure out what's going on.
There's a couple times they do this in the movie where the book is much, much seedier. You know, there's homosexual aspects in the book.
Right.
And they kind of tip the hat a little bit toward that in the movie you're really watching for. My wife caught it and I didn't. And she didn't know anything about the book. And then later, you know, and also this thing with Donna Reed and the club she worked at, escort might be another word people would use. Got to keep the boys happy, and she had to mingle and all this
mingle,
stuff.
Mingle, dance
she got
a little
quite
bit,
a,
whatever.
Yeah, she got a big crush on one character.
Montgomery Clift, who plays Sergeant Pruitt.
Prue, yes.
That's who Donna Reed. Donna Reed. Plays the hostess that and Prue becomes a little possessive in terms of that and it plays up to the Prue was against when he being in service. In fact, Henry Cohn, the head of Columbia Studios that made this movie, was dead set against Montgomery Clift playing this role. He wanted the guy that was just a little bit more manly. Montgomery Clift was, everybody knew he was gay. And even though it doesn't, he when you watch him on the screen, he portrays himself as being more, not gay, but sensitive, I would call it.
Yeah,
you know,
what's those sensitive, eyes?
There's a lot
those
of sensibility.
Yeah, his eyes. He did a lot with his eyes. They're big and blue and almost watery.
Yeah.
Sensitive looking
guy. So we had Donna Reed. Here's another one that we don't think about too much, George Reeves. Superman is in this movie.
Yes, he is.
Superman doesn't have a very big role, but a very pivotal role. He's the one who lets, when Burt Lancaster starts getting serious with Deborah Kerr and, you know, risking his military career, Reeves comes up to him and says, by the way, Sarge, I want to give you a little warning here. This lady's been around the block more than once. She's been tossed around, and a lot of guys have had her, including myself. So just I want you to be aware of that. He has this one little scene. What's interesting is that a lot of people feel that George Reeves, because his part in the movie, although important, is so small, that he was cut out of the movie. A lot of his movie, a part of it was cut out. It wasn't.
Not true.
What you see is what you get, and it's very good. And there was this rumor that they previewed the movie, and when they saw George Reeves out there, the crowd went nuts. Superman, Superman. It was such a distraction, they felt. This is all urban myth because it didn't work out that way. So that was all.
And he did a good job, too. I think he had the military bearing, certainly. And he delivered his lines great, and he had his hair trimmed military fashion. He looked good. And my God, I was so surprised how big that guy is. You always see him in the Superman thing, and you think, oh, well, whatever. But
yeah, they figure they got all that padding on him. But in this one, he's got his Hawaiian shirt on, and he's up against Burt Lancaster, who's a very physical guy. And Burt is, you know, it looks a little bit small compared to George in that scene.
So, yeah, I agree.
There's a couple other people in this movie that got their film careers kind of started. One of them is Jack Warden. He's in it.
Yeah.
You'll see him in the movie. It's one of his first ones. There's another fellow named Claude Akins who is in the movie that you will that was actually his very first role. They were part of the boxing team that were trying to pressure Sergeant Pruitt, played by Montgomery Clift, to be a part of their boxing team. And they really, you know, harassed him and did a lot of punishment type stuff. But Pruitt would not give in. He stuck to his guns. The reason he didn't want to box was that he had basically in another unit had seriously injured a boxer. And so he felt that he didn't want to hurt anybody. He was that good. And that's the reason he shied away from boxing and was concentrating on his trumpet player and just wanted to be a regular soldier.
Yep.
The other person we haven't mentioned is Ernest Borgnine.
Oh, wow.
You talk about against type. Ooh. Ernest Borgnine, I wouldn't call him necessarily against type. He played a variety of roles up to that point.
Yeah.
But he did play, he played a vicious, sadistic, bad guy who was running the prison.
And he would do all this sadism with a smile.
Oh. He was
wow,
bad.
Was that evil. That was bad. Oh, what a character. Yeah.
So Sinatra ends up running up against this guy in the social club and basically gives him a hard time and says his piano playing's too loud and this and that. And Ernest Borgnine very prophetically says, "You will end up in the stockade, and when you do, I will have you." And sure enough, Sinatra one night when he's supposed to be on duty, he ends up getting drunk and goes to the social club and gets arrested by the MPs for you know, being AWOL.
Dereliction of duty, yep.
And he ends up in there, and as a result, he ends up dying in there. And he does get out just enough to kind of let him know how bad the Borgnine had treated him. And, of course, Montgomery Clift has to play revenge. And, well, that's there's a lot here. Interactions are so good in this movie.
Yeah,
so I guess as we take a look at this whole thing, we need to think about the fact that again, we have a place where you watch it and you say, you know what's going to happen, you know war is, you know, just right there and going to happen around the corner, and the kind of attitude that you see where people are just trying to live their lives and really not concentrating on it. So when the war does start, and by the way, the whole war thing where you know, I can get baseball into anything, and I can get baseball into this movie, because
that's
what
right.
happens is when they are bombing, they found out later on, and this is the truth, not the movie, that the Japanese put more craters in baseball fields than any place else.
Oh.
They basically, the bombs would hit and a lot of people say, well, they must have felt there was oil reserves or some tanks underneath ground or something. No, baseball. Japan basically used the baseball as propaganda, and you know, to hell with Babe Ruth. You don't let blacks play. They use all kinds of ways to about baseball. And of course, baseball had already been played pretty well professionally in Japan in the 30s. They abolished baseball in 1942.
Wow!
They filmed the scene there where we're watching all the bombing in the movie. They actually had to show you how economically they were. They had that whole thing filmed within a half a day. Do you believe
that's incredible? That's incredible.
Yeah. So
it was good.
Yeah,
too. It was a well done little end of the movie there where they had the zeros coming in and you know, Burt Lancaster marshaled all his troops and stuff and. Burt Lancaster really did a great job in the whole movie, but he was a great commander.
He was an excellent first sergeant, and being in the Army, being in Vietnam in a combat zone, I can tell you right now that the fact that Burt Lancaster is running the company rather than the commanding officer doesn't surprise me in the very least. That's what I lived. It's
wow.
Like top, we called him top. Top was the what you call the first sergeant. And he was the man who ran everything. So, that didn't surprise me at all. So it's again an incredible movie. It's got the platform is the war and the prelude to the war, the beginning of the war. But
okay.
There's so much more to this. It's truly amazing.
Yeah, so, you have to watch it. You have to watch it. But that said, let's take it to current events a bit. And this is now we're getting to a point where. We're going to talk a little about Korea, and we've talked about this on another podcast. And, you know, the strategies that the U.S. and allies were using to keep Korea from successfully launching a missile, to building a bomb, to doing all this stuff. Well, we all got a big surprise about the time G2 is about to convene in Hamburg. The Koreans, in fact, the day before, I think, the Koreans were able to not just launch a missile successfully. They did a number of things. Number one, they launched a missile 19,000 miles into space and back down again, more or less where they wanted it to land. Now, this is a huge demonstration in two respects. One, that is a good demonstration that they can control what they're doing with a missile. Number two, that's what they need to do in order to hit Alaska or something like that in the United States. And that demonstration was very convincing and got a lot of people's attention and really caught a lot of people by surprise. And one other thing about this, they did this from a portable launch. In other words, they wheeled in the missile and the launch base and 2 hours later launched it, which means that this is going to be a very hard to detect launch. Number two, the parabola, the height and then descent of this thing was so sharp that it would be virtually impossible to do the missile-on-missile kind of thing that's kind of impossible anyway. But it would really be impossible if you had that kind of arc on a missile. And they demonstrated that they could do it. And as we talked about before, they've got a bunch of Russian scientists who couldn't find work after the Soviet Union broke up, who live there, work there, and are running that whole thing. So that's bad news. And this is, as John said, it's a lot, well, as we said, somewhat like what we went through with the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, it's not 90 miles away, but in a lot of ways it is, because we are South Korea, and South Korea is us in a lot of ways in terms of military. They depend upon us. We watch the border for them. We have had operations there continuously since the 1950s, and none of this is good. It's all bad, and it should make people a little nervous, more than a little nervous.
Well, a couple of comments. Number one, you mentioned the fact that, having this arc and the vertical dive or the route of the missile, and you mentioned missile to missile. When we talked about this earlier, we kind of compared it, although it's a stretch a little bit. It's like if you were going to take a gun and shoot somebody, but rather than shooting him, what you did is you say, well, I'm going to just hit their bullet with my bullet. As they shoot me, and you think about it and you say, well, that's really Mission Impossible. Not quite that extreme with the missile, but it's close, too close to that, unfortunately.
Right.
It's difficult. And as much as we talk about defensive missiles, if that's going to be our primary stand of defense, we're in trouble. And as you've mentioned before, more likely having the ability to screw around with the technology on a sort of
disrupt their
basis,
supply lines,
that. A couple things have come out of this that this isn't the first missile, obviously, that they've launched. They've been doing this now for some time, and it's kind of been on the back burner for a couple reasons. One is obviously the success and the nature of this one. Prior to this, we had a fair number of failures played into it. The other thing is that the background of this country is so bleak and so unknown. What we hear is not very good. I mean, this is just this missile thing. The background to that is a country that is calling it a third world country is probably an overstatement in terms of the way that people are living. It's just so meager and just so unreal poverty. We've always felt, quite often we feel more serious about people that have the resources such as the Middle East and oil, while our posture has been, well, North Korea, they don't have anything. Who cares?
Yeah, people don't take them seriously. That's the problem.
So now we've got to, take them a little bit more serious than we've got to. And when you talk about, see, the Cuban Missile Crisis was kind of interesting. I did a little background on that to compare. Back in 1962, we became aware that Russia was supplying Cuba with the necessary parts and actually helping them construct missile bases located in Cuba, which is 90 miles away from the U.S. The background of that is that why does Cuba request that from Russia? Because they had been invaded in the previous year, the Bay of Pigs invasion by the U.S., and they felt right. they needed to bolster their defense. In addition to the fact that we also, the U.S. had established missile bases in Turkey. So
right,
you say,
right.
well, this is an oppressor Russian country that is basically taking over Cuba and putting bases close to us, is what we all heard back in the early 60s.
Yep.
When you look at the background story, there's a little more balance to it than that.
Right.
Basically, Russia is reacting to what we started in many ways. And part of the negotiations, as they were, first what we did is we blockaded the ships that were coming forth with all the missile parts, et cetera, from Russia. And then what we had to do is we had to negotiate. But you have to understand, we're in a period at that point of Cold War. Cold War was basically Russia versus U.S., and we're just waiting for the bomb to go off. You know, I mean, we had
– Yep.
What did we build? We built the shelters, the bomb shelters.
Bomb shelters,
you know,
yep.
Yeah. And so as nice as the 50s were in terms of the U.S., we constantly had in our back of our minds, what's Russia up to next?
Yeah, you know? And we were trained to hide under our desks, you know, and all
yeah,
this kind of
at
stuff.
Yeah, school and the whole bit like that. It was all air raid, you know, practice and this and that, whatever. So, so here we are. It'll be interesting to see how this is done. We do it now. When we dealt with the U.S., it was U.S. versus Russia primarily. Now what we have is we've got some other people in the cast. We've obviously got Russia's in it again. China is in it. South Korea, Japan, because this is not near us. This is it's when you say it's 90 miles from us. Well, it's a little closer than that to South Korea. They're like adjacent to it.
Yeah.
So
there's another things here. Another things that we need to watch for. I think one is anything we can do to get more insight into what's going on in North Korea is great. And I would recommend to people if they have the time is that there's a great little piece done in NPR that we just had here in Austin. It's called Watching Foreign Movies is Illegal in North Korea, but some do it anyway. And that's an incredible good interview. And it's also an article written on it too. And the amazing thing is, I've often wondered, how do these people even eat? How do they do anything? Because they're cut off entirely from the rest of the world. China's about their only trading partner, and China's had to become more strict and more strict. They buy coal from them, but China cut the coal by 60%. So what's happening inside there? How are they surviving? And turns out that everything is a black market, and everything's being done with bribing, and they have very active trade going on, but it's totally all, unofficial. And the people who are doing this are risking their lives because if they get caught, they do get shot. Just boom. Everyone knows famously that this leader of the country shot his own uncle assassinated his uncle a few months ago. And, in public, in Manila, in an airport. So, these people live under all this. And I heard interviews in this thing where this girl talked about the first time she saw a movie and how she had to stand sit a few inches from the TV and turn the sound down as low as possible. And she watched the Titanic movie and she was stunned. She'd never seen people display emotions. The only love that was permitted in North Korea was love of the leader who was considered a divinity of some sort. And so when she saw this boy and this girl and this romance and him give up his life for her, she was amazed and moved. And that began her determination to get the hell out of there. But before that, she knew nothing and then started buying DVDs and stuff and trading and doing whatever it took to do them. And they had another interview with another guy who sold DVDs and they just said, and he spoke English and he was out of North Korea by that time, but not very long. And they said, well, what would have happened if you would have gotten caught? And he said, like, in a completely calm voice, I would have been killed, you know? And just like, hey, that's, was it worth it? Oh, yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
He had no, I mean, this is really informative to me about what's going on, more than, you know, these stupid intelligence reports, which obviously are totally worthless because no one had any idea that they could launch a missile like this. It wouldn't surprise me if they've been doing flubbed missile launches for the last year and a half to lull us into a sense of false security.
Quite possible. The other thing we didn't even mention in our prep is there was that one young person who basically was near death that had gone to Korea that the Koreans finally released, and within a couple of months he just died here. So, you know, I can
not,
you know,
not even that long. I think it was a week or something.
Yeah,
it was really quick.
So the bottom line is that we get these bits and pieces of learning about it, but we don't get the whole picture as to what's happening behind all those missiles. And the fact is that, although we see a country with a population that is in a state of desperation, we don't know how that's all going to evolve and how quickly.
We don't know how long before someone's deposed, before the leader's deposed. And the real fear among intelligence people that I've heard interviewed say, well, there's no good outcomes here. If there is a revolt of some sort, there are going to be some diehard devotees of the current leader who will undoubtedly take power, and they may be double crazy. They may be, they may just press the button, you know, that they are, they may be even worse. That's the fear, and that they don't see any way to handle this. I don't think anyone has a strategy. Well, of course, if they did, they wouldn't say it, but I hope someone is doing some thinking on this, because Seoul is just so close to Pyongyang, North Korea, that they could easily, you know, kill millions of people, just in a blink. And this could start off an incredible problem. Now, let's take it really modern day. G2, Trump, Putin, Chinese leader. These guys, if they put their heads together, they could do something. And I don't see many other options. I think that this may be fortuitous that President Trump is so chummy with Putin. This may actually prove to be helpful as regards Korea. Of course, we'll probably pay for it in the end, but that may work. And then also, you know, Trump started out pretty well with the Chinese leader and has fumbled the ball a few times since then, but he could regain ground with him too. And if these three individuals work together, then something might be able to happen as regards North Korea. Because, you know, this is not as simple as Cuba. There's no blockade to have here. Because whatever comes into North Korea comes in over the land, and that means Russia and China can play a big part in that because they control some of those borders.
I think that Russia has a real incentive to step up to the plate here. The reason being that, you know, with the breakup of the Soviet Union, their status as a world power has been diminished to some extent. That's not to say that they're off the table completely, but this would be an opportunity for them to step up, be able to get there, to regain some of the recognition as a leader,
world power
that they've somewhat lost in the last, you know, 20, 30 years. So, and Putin is the kind of guy who would really like that to happen. So
yes,
with that in
he's
mind,
got a lot of pride.
He's got a lot of pride, and so this could, like you said, could work in our favor, definitely in the short term, only who knows what could happen in the long term with respect to this. So the fact that we were talking in terms of Trump and the Russian maybe being a little tight, and the way you could just see the way the G2 was handled with respect G20. To them getting together. G20, excuse me. Dropped a number there.
Well, G2 and, is military intelligence, so you weren't far off. Right?
Yeah, you're right. So I got him just a little too confused. Yeah, baseball's my mistake, let's face it. But the point being that there's just a really good opportunity here in terms of the way they conducted themselves, I thought was funny. way that Trump brings out right away the things that the news want him to and kind of gets it off the table. But just the way they postured and they talked to each other, it wasn't like Nikita Khrushchev where he's got his arms folded and he's sitting back in his chair and he's defiant.
Or pounding his shoe on the table. That was good.
You see these guys like with their arms on their knees kind of, you know,
leaning into
each other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
the body language
is incredible.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the man spreading. I've heard about that too. That somebody commented on that. The way they sit with their legs apart, you know.
And the expressions. It's like you could see. My favorite was when I was watching Putin and Trump as he's denying everything. You could see by the look on his face, we got away with something, didn't we? You know.
Yeah, Trump knows it. He knows it. And you know, the thing is that we may have the perfect president for this particular thing because. He just might be able to work a deal. He's not the great deal maker everybody thinks he is, but this may work because Putin has something, that we need and we have something Putin needs. And you hit it on the head, John. He needs prestige and recognition. And Trump is enough of a player to give that to him. And so that would be fairly huge. And Putin is not a fool. He may be a little prideful, but man, he is super intelligent. And here's a guy who is not building tons of missiles and what have you. Here's a guy who is like doing his thing with computers. And we all know what that is. And he's doing it. But what was somebody said? They said, no one plays a weak hand better than Putin. And that is absolutely
true.
Nice. Isn't that beautiful? And that is what somebody needs to do. Somebody needs to do something totally out of the box here. The usual stuff is not going to work. And usual stuff is all you get out of Washington. And so this may be the godsend, you know, that we really need. It may turn out that President Trump does something remarkable with these two other guys. And I hope so. Fingers crossed.
Well, G20, what's happened in G20 is kind of some of the other pieces, such as us working a little bit closer with Russia in terms of Syria, kind of gives us a step towards, you know, a little closer to being able to work with Russia.
Oh, yeah. And they immediately got a ceasefire underway 4 hours before that meeting with Trump. So that was big.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can see that what's happening here, our ability to work with Russia is being enhanced by some of the other ancillary things that are taking place in G20.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's all keep an eye on this stuff. And we've went over a little bit here, but boy, John, this was a good one. Super good work on your part.
Oh, thank you. And yeah, it was a pleasure. I always enjoy reading about things and learning new stuff. And even with the baseball side, reading this new book I have called The Game Must Go On by a guy named John Klein. It came out a couple of years ago. I was able to find a couple. I was just fascinated by it. You can always learn more. I don't care what your expertise might be. I've always said that when it comes to people say, boy, you know everything about baseball. I said, I knew what I knew about baseball when I realized what I didn't know.
Yeah.
When you realize
what
you're still in front of you, that's when you really know your subject.
So, I agree. Well, this was great. And we'll hit it again. I'll talk to you tomorrow. And
everybody out there,
shirt.thebro.show.
Good.
Do it.
Very good.
Do it.
Okay. Well, listen, have a good day. Be talking to you.